So this panel is voter ID requirements. Hopefully everybody is in the correct place. To kick off the first session of the afternoon, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Kelly Pinkleton, the director of the Voting Rights Institute in Secretary Bruner's office. We have an expert panel in the truest sense of the word today, with diverse backgrounds that will have a lot of things to share with you. I'm going to go over a little bit about the format of the session, then I'll introduce the panelists and we'll get started. This, like all of the other sessions, and I've attended a session each time we've had one, they have all been interactive. This one is also going to be interactive. We have the panel, but you also are serving as panelists today, so we want to hear from you. The panelists are happy to answer any questions, comment on things, but it's key that you participate. That's really what this conference is about. So I'll go ahead and start by introducing our panel today. Starting next to me, we have Dr. Ted Allen, Associate Professor at The Ohio State University. Next to Dr. Allen, we have Karen Newman, Legal Director for Fair Elections Legal Network. To the right of Karen, we have Peg Rosenfeld, the election specialist with the League of Women Voters of Ohio.
Your right.
Whichever. Next to Peg, we have Brian Shin, Assistant General Counsel and Elections Counsel in the Ohio Secretary of State's office. Also from the Ohio Secretary of State's office, we have Pat Wolf, Elections Administrator. Go ahead, clap for him. I want to make sure everybody has a handout. You should have them at your table. If not, we have, I think Dean or Dale in the back may have some. I also, before we get started, want to acknowledge the lovely Ann Block, who is taking notes for us today. Regional liaison. On the handout, we have kind of three main themes we're going to be talking about. Again, we want your comments, suggestions, and thoughts. The three main themes are, again, about voter ID, easing voter identification laws. The second one is discussing a shift potentially from identity verification to address verification. We want to get your comments on that. And finally, the third topic or area we would like to cover is thoughts on redesigning the Ohio driver's license. So with that, before we open it up to our audience, I'm going to have each of the panelists, if they would, say a couple words to share with us. And I'll start with you, Dr. Allen.
Thank you. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you for coming today. This topic is, I feel important because it could help get many more people in America involved with elections or help that, but it also could potentially cause a degradation, a serious degradation in the voter confidence. What I'm here, and yet it's also a huge challenge, because I think yesterday we heard that the prospects for immediate reform in this area are difficult. And so I feel the way to address possibly this this challenge, if we are going to make any changes, I think the need is for data, new kinds of data, and more of it. I think everyone here would agree with that, and I've seen on the web many reputable articles about the need for data to support changes in voter identification rules. And what I bring is not a long experience in this area. I'm much more knowledgeable, for example, about how many voting machines you need to reduce waiting lines. And I don't bring hardly any legal knowledge about the state laws. And I don't even bring that much familiarity that you guys have, or everyone here has much more than me, with the firsthand dealing with people with challenges and their frustrations on this issue. So I don't bring any of those things. But what I might bring is a lot of experience in dispassionately collecting many different kinds of data to support process improvement, and sometimes in pretty contentious environments with people's jobs on the line. We industrial engineers, statistician kind of people, industrial statistician types, we're often fighting right against a union, and we're trying to, in a way, get rid of their jobs. So they're kind of mad sometimes. So I'm used to that. And as a result, we've developed a rather extensive set of statistical technology and management technology that can prepare visuals. And sometimes those visuals can be the magic trick to moving past arguments. And so I just want to give you a little bit of a feel for some of the kinds of data that you might not think of. Now, clearly, there's surveys of, okay, well, how would you feel if we made this change to the law, if we allowed passports, or if we removed the location requirements? We can ask those questions, and they should be asked. But there's also data sets that we get often in medical domains or other domains where we put in new technology and we do scenarios, and we observe, for example, poll workers trying to be taught how to administer this new law. And then we have the poll worker go through administering the law, and we can count on videotape the number of errors, the amount of time things take, and then we vary the policies. So that those type of analyses, which are often ethnographic, which means we go into the real environment and observe, can be a rich source of data. Another source of data that you might not be thinking about has to do with systematic counting of the incidents logged by your poll workers. You know, those incident reports can be a rich source. So I think one of the things that we systems engineers can add to the many other interested parties is a potentially more all-encompassing set of data sources and a potentially richer set of visuals to display those data. And I think if we get to that point, and I want to be a part of that, even if I have to volunteer to do this, I want to be a part of that effort. And if we get to that point, I think that will be the key to breaking any logjam that's occurring in the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Allen. Karen? Yes, those should be on.
Thank you. First of all, I want to start by congratulating the officials in Ohio for an election well run. I'm sure that people in here are relieved that the focus has been on Minnesota this time and not on your state. I want to just tell you a little bit about the Fair Elections Legal Network. We are a national nonpartisan advocacy organization. We've worked with many state and local officials around the country on election administration issues, including voter ID, but also provisional voting, statewide voter registration database issues, resource allocation, that type of thing. And we've had some discussions with officials in the Secretary's office and locally. We've paid particular attention to the impact of voter ID laws on student voters and have spent a lot of time working with local officials to either support their creative efforts, including Secretary Bruner's, to facilitate the ability of students to prove identity at the polling place, or we've made recommendations to others who may not have yet thought so creatively. As our organization has worked over the years on this, it's become apparent to me that after the 2000 election, we find ourselves in this interesting situation where people felt compelled, state legislatures felt compelled to implement fairly stringent voter ID requirements while at the same time trying to include provisions that call for an expansive list of forms of identification, which is very well intentioned, but at times is very confusing to poll workers and the public alike. And I will look forward to participating in this discussion with this final concluding thought that doesn't represent necessarily the view of my organization, but I think my own view is with the availability of technology and the potential for confusion at the polling place about what, as poll workers try to examine ID and various forms of identification, I wonder why we don't just have signature match as an acceptable form of identification. We do it in other contexts. I am not a technology person, but I suspect that the technology, if isn't already available to us, is rapidly approaching where we can confirm ID at the polling place with a signature on the registration form. Oregon does that in their mail-in system. They confirm the signature on the mail-in ballot with that on the registration form. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Peg?
I can talk loud, but I like a microphone. Okay, I'm not too subtle about this. I trust people who disagree with me will challenge my opinions and try and show me why I'm wrong. Why did we ever give up signature verification as the way we identify you at the polls? I appreciate people seeming to be very concerned that somebody's going to try to impersonate me and vote in my name, but I don't think that's a big problem we have in Ohio, and that's the only reason not to use signature verification, and in fact, their signature does protect me from being impersonated. I guess I get upset over this for, among other things. My 95-year-old mother would not have been able to vote in Ohio under the requirements that we currently have. Fortunately for her and for you, she died before those requirements were put into the law, or you'd have had a real fight on your hands. I can't figure out why we allowed this to get changed. But as I say, if you can convince me, I'm maybe convincible on this. And as far as some of these other things, if you can figure out how to get the Bureau of Motor Vehicles to change their design, rot's a rock. It's such a simple thing to change that you'd think it would be easy, but this is a bureaucracy I'm not going to try and take on.
Thank you, Peg. Brian?
Good afternoon. It's kind of hard to keep straight what topic I'm talking about today, but this is the fourth one. But we're actually here seriously to talk about ID requirements. I think my preliminary statement, and again, as an election attorney in the Secretary of State's office, my role in this function is not to tell you what I think, I personally think, it's more what the law is or what the law should be, maybe to a certain extent. I think it's clear, given that the United States Supreme Court upheld Indiana's ID law, which by all accounts is much more restrictive than Ohio's law, that these laws are constitutional, at least under the current makeup of the United States Supreme Court. I think we all heard at lunch yesterday there's some disagreement among our elected representatives in the General Assembly about, given that fact that it's constitutional, should we go more restrictive, should we go less restrictive, should we keep it the way it is? I think from my dealings with the elections officials and the 18 counties that I work with, that it is a confusing requirement for your poll workers. It's not very straightforward. There are many permutations to the ID laws. In certain contexts, you can have, for example, if you're on the poll book in the polling place, which you all know, you can show up with an Ohio driver's license that doesn't have an address that matches your driver's license or your address in the poll book and the records of the Board of Elections, and you can still vote a regular ballot. But yet, in another context, if your notice of election, or excuse me, your acknowledgement and card comes back, then you have to have a driver's license that does have an address that matches your address on the records of the Boards of Elections. If you vote by absentee ballot, you only need the last four digits of your Social Security number. You know, there are varying standards in the law, and it creates confusion for the Boards of Elections, and it certainly creates confusion for your poll workers in training and on election day. Now, what have we tried to do to clarify that? Well, I think those of you who've been in elections for a little while know that all these changes came with House Bill 3 in 2006. When Secretary Bruner came on board as Secretary of State, we issued first Directive 2007-06 that tried to clarify voter ID requirements. That directive was really big and unwieldy because it was provisional voting and ID all in one directive. In 2008, we broke that directive into three, the absentee voting portion two, and we issued Directive 2008-80 to try to clarify to a certain extent what ID requirements are. And then we also had things like the flip chart that we provided to every polling place in Ohio and mandated that you had to have available. So I guess my bottom line is, without going into too much detail about at this point what the law should be or what it is that just the acknowledgement that laws are complicated and it causes a lot of confusion with your poll workers. We do continue to get a lot of questions from the boards and from people on election day about ID things. And I think whatever the General Assembly does, if they do decide to change the law, they should make it a lot more streamlined just for the sake of the ease of elections officials and the public so that they know what's going to be acceptable and what isn't.
Thank you, Brian. And finally, Pat Wolf.
Dr. Allen had made some mention about statistics, more data, et cetera. Just wanted to bring up one thing from provisional balloting, which this time we did do a check of rejections for provisional ballots. Of the 206,000 plus that were cast, and those that were counted, about 166,000, we had a rejection rate of about 5,000 due to lack of proper ID. So right around, just around 1,900 voters that dealt with voter ID was the reason for rejection of their provisional ballots. So it's one area, as Brian talked about, where the different standards, even though for a driver's license we have different standards depending on the circumstances for which that voter has been marked in the poll book, and it does get confusing. So I think it's one of the areas that it definitely looks like there would need to be a legislative change to sort of clarify exactly what needs to be done. And I'd like to hear from the boards out there. I see several of you sitting out there. The primary problems that your poll workers are having with the current law as it stands now.
Thank you, panel. And again, as a reminder, we have kind of a few questions we'd like for you to answer, throw out ideas. I know in a previous panel I was in, I think it was Brian that addressed it, you know, this conference and this panel is about solutions, so any solutions you have, we definitely want to hear that. Key questions: how can we best streamline voter ID laws to lessen the burden on poll workers and voters alike? Should Ohio change the law to focus on identity verification rather than address verification? And finally, can Ohio alter driver's licenses to fix the problem? And if so, how do you recommend, or what fixes do you recommend? Yes.
I just have a question, and the way I understand it, I'm Robin Lehman from Montgomery County, that notifications from the Board of Elections is not allowed as a source of voter ID. Couldn't the Board of Elections issue sort of like a voter ID card and then match up the voter ID number that's on the card with the voter ID number that's in the book? That could be sort of like a double check.
To answer your question, yes, there's nothing that says your board couldn't do that. I don't think we would want to mandate that. Certainly that would be another enormous expense on the boards of elections. But if the Board of Elections were to produce such a card, I think it could qualify as an other government document under the current scheme. But I know for a lot of my counties, and I have some pretty small rural counties, that would be another burden placed on them if they were to have to do that. But yes, just to answer the purely legal question, I think you could do it, and it would qualify as another government document as long as it contained their current address. And then your election, your poll workers could match that to the number, like you said, in the poll book. Of course, they still have to sign in, too.
Any other thoughts from the panel? Karen?
I would just note that there are a number of other states that do accept voter cards as a form of identification.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, ma'am.
As part of when people change their addresses and the Board of Elections sends out a confirmation card or whatever they call it, could that confirmation card be used as the ID requirement?
If your question is under current law, no notice from the Board of Elections can serve as ID. And the reason for that from a policy matter is that the assumption is that they want to independently verify your residence. If you're just getting a notice based on what the Board of Elections sends you, let's say you came in and used a fraudulent address, and then the board sends out a notice to that fraudulent address, there is no independent verification on that. That's why a notice from the boards of elections doesn't serve as a proper ID under the law. Again, I don't want to get too wrapped up on what the law is. I think we want to talk about what the law should be, but you know, that's at least my understanding. And Pat, you've been around a bit longer than I have, of why a notice from the Board of Elections cannot serve as ID.
Yeah, I think Brian, it is exactly what Brian was talking about. Is if you have someone that's registered at a bad address, you don't want to use that same bad address then to verify their identity. So that was one of the reasons that the General Assembly put that in there, that you couldn't use one that was sent out for identity. I think what you talked about with your voter ID card as far as numbers and verification, because at that point in time, by the time you send the card out, and you if you send that card out and it comes back, you know now that you have an issue as far as the address or a possible problem with the Postal Service that needs to be checked out. So you have some type of verifiable information that you can take a look at versus just having them use that card.
Thank you. Karen?
Oh, sorry. And one thing to keep in mind that may not have been on any of our radar screens in past election cycles, but I would caution against amending a law that would rely too heavily on a card that's sent to a specific address, because, for example, we had a class of voters around the country who lost their homes due to foreclosure. And I don't know when these cards are mailed out in Ohio, but those voters would have been precluded from relying on those cards for ID purposes in the state if that were the sole form of ID, or if it was address-based.
Well, and this brings up the whole mindset when House Bill 3 was passed, which is that there is massive fraud going on out there, and that they have to prevent that because we've got all these people registering to vote as Mickey Mouse, and they're going to show up at the polls and vote. And so we have to be very careful and make sure that all this fraud isn't going to affect the outcome of an election. If you perhaps pick up from me that I think this is totally fallacious reasoning, you're right, and why I keep going back to, let's go back to the signature verification, which worked just fine for decades in Ohio.
Thank you. Commoner question?
Hi. My name is Kyle Boland, and I work for Ohio Campus Compact, a nonpartisan nonprofit in Granville, Ohio. It's a membership-based organization that works with higher education to cultivate more opportunities for students to be involved in service learning and civic engagement opportunities. I'd like to give you a conflicting statement. First, I definitely agree that the current system is very complicated, and it's a burden on both voters and poll workers. And now allow me to advocate to add an ID for the approved list, because I think we are missing a very important one that I saw working on the 08 election, and that was primarily out-of-state students who live on campus do not have an Ohio driver's license. And under the current law, a student ID, even though it does have a picture, cannot be used. It could be used at public institutions if it has an address, but no university that I know of or college provides an address for it. And so what happened in 2008 was our organization and a bunch of others advocated for private campuses to issue fake, just made up utility bills, and public campuses sent notes via email to students with their name and address, because it was a public college, so they were allowed to use that as ID. It took a lot of time. Usually it took some initiative of the student, but it was reliant on the fact that the university or college wanted to get involved. If a student went to a campus that did not want to get involved in that, because it did take a lot of significant time from the registrar's office, financial aid, so on and so forth, the student could not get a proper ID to vote. So I wanted to ask what your opinion on adding a college ID to the list in the current system of the complicated system. And I just add one other note. There was some campuses that I found that were actually discouraging out-of-state students for voting in Ohio which should not be the role of a educational institution, because it is the students' right to choose, and I think we should be providing, we would actually want the student to vote here because ultimately we want them to stay and live and work and pay taxes in Ohio. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Kyle. And before the panel addresses, one thing I want to make you aware of that impacts, certainly in every presidential election, there's a lot of talk, discussion on college students and voting. Current federal legislation that's being looked at, which, you know, I'm sure may be of interest to some of you, is amending the National Voting Rights Act to add that colleges and universities fall kind of under the same umbrella as social service agencies, BMV. So that will be some federal legislation, I know, to watch, that Kyle would be interested in seeing what happens to it, and certainly others. College ID, what does the panel, what does the panel think about that?
Oh, yeah.
Before, when I was preparing for this meeting today, I talked with Matt Damschroeder and Karen Cotton from the Franklin County Board of Elections, and I hope they don't mind that I'm mentioning them. But they actually came up with a surprising recommendation to me, which was that actually by including more valid ID options would simplify the process. That was their hypothesis, and that was their recommendation too. And so one of the things that I'm perceiving is that, you know, there are several options that could theoretically be taken, like going back to the signature system or expanding the list of valid IDs, and also in many cases reducing the requirements on location. And I'm seeing all these options, and I think more and more options is good. You should have a lot of options, and you shouldn't just stick on a few when you're trying to gather data, particularly since we're not, I don't think there's any imminent law coming around. So I see a lot of options, and I do think that we could theoretically as a society challenge ourselves to do better. Because, you know, the signature thing, it's probably better than what we have now, but it wasn't a great success. You know, this country has had pretty lousy, numbers of people voting for years. And so, half of our society is not participating. That's not a good thing. And so, you know, theoretically, there could be fairly substantial improvements related to these issues.
Thanks, Ted. Karen?
Sure. A couple of things. First of all, our organization worked with yours on helping implement this, and the only thing I would say about the characterization is I wouldn't characterize it as a fake utility bill. I would characterize it as a document. Sorry?
Zero balance.
Right, I would characterize it as a document that indicates that there's a zero balance for allocation of utility costs in housing. That aside, I think my own view is that as long as you have a system where you're going to require documentary forms of ID, you may as well have an expansive list. That said, I think it's very confusing. As those lists grow, it gets very confusing for poll workers, especially in the crush of election day, to just sort through and identify which forms are on the list, which aren't. My own view, and I think I agree with Peg, is that signature verification eliminates the potential for confusion. I actually don't think that signature verification is the reason why we've had low voter turnout in past elections. I think it has to do with other factors. But I would also say that your call for concrete statistics on voter ID might help support a move towards signature verification if legislators can be persuaded that the potential forms of fraudulent voting, which would be voter impersonation or perhaps duplicate voting, occur very, very infrequently.
Anyone else on the panel?
We can go into this more. The next set has one on illegal voting. I have every intention of going to that one.
I just want to say one thing. I think, you know, it's kind of one of those. There's always been a tension, at least in my understanding, in Ohio and in a lot of other states about whether college students should be voting at home or where they're going to school. And I think that that's kind of a reflection of what's in the law. I know there are counties that have colleges or universities, and some of them have a great relationship with colleges and universities, and in other counties, they don't have a very good relationship. And I think it's a constant tension in at least Ohio elections that whether these people should be voting or not, and it seems like the system clearly makes it more difficult. But on the other hand, anybody can go open a bank account, issue their address, and get issued a bank account statement, and that bank account statement is a valid form of ID under the law. So on the other hand, there are some easy things that college and university students can do, whether they're at a public university or a private university, that gives them a form of ID. So I just want to acknowledge that I think that that tension is there. I've heard it from elections officials. I've heard many people say, well, they shouldn't be voting here anyway. They don't pay taxes here, yada, yada, yada. And then I've heard, college students say, well, the only reason I'm doing this is because this is a swing state and it's going to make more difference for me to vote here than home. And I think it's a tension that we have to at least acknowledge that's there.
Yes, sir.
Are we forgetting about the fact that a college student or anyone else can register to vote before the deadline and not have to go through all this? We're talking about things.
Are you talking about voting absentee, sir?
Just being registered. If you're registered prior to the deadline, you can get an absentee ballot, you can go to the polls, you can do anything you want.
You can't go to the polls.
Are you talking about mail-in absentee?
No, I'm just talking about going and registering at your local Board of Elections or sending in a registration card prior to the deadline, and you can find. So you're saying they don't even have an ID to do that with?
No, they have to have ID if they vote at the polls.
We're talking about university people who are registered voters, but the problem they have voting because they don't have the kind of ID that's necessary to cast a ballot. So this is the whole thing we're talking about.
They are registered voters, but they have to show ID
What did they use to register with when they
registered? All they need in the register is the last four digits of their social security number.
And a physical address.
Okay. All right. I understand.
Thank you. Mr. Wilkinson?
Jeff Wilkinson, Richland County Board of Elections Deputy Director. You know, I think our goal in this whole thing is to simplify the process for the poll workers. You know, we talk about poll worker recruitment and all the things involved with that. I feel that a simple photo ID, we all use them in everyday life, whether we have a driver's license or a state ID card, would suffice in that respect for voter ID laws in Ohio. And I also think that boards of elections could be equipped with I can't tell you the name of the device, but there's a device that takes a picture and produces an ID for those people who don't have or can't buy one, that we could utilize those things. And you know, the Secretary of State has a lot of HAVA funds, and they're using them for administrative purposes. We just got something in the email that said they're spending a lot of that money for administrative purposes. Why not utilize some of that money, if possible, to assist boards of elections to get that type of technology? Be very simple.
Also, Indiana's law, they allow, you can go and get, paid for by the state, a ID card, and the state takes care of that, and they have all kinds of different locations where you can get it. That would probably be a good solution, too.
Yeah, except that you have to have a birth certificate to get that initial ID, which is not trivial. It now costs $15 to $20 to get a birth certificate from most states. And there are lots of other problems that I see involved, particularly with the elderly, and if they're in nursing homes, they can't get down there to get their picture taken. You may not believe this, but my mother never had a birth certificate. Period. And in order, it was a hassle when she had to get a passport because she had no birth certificate. There was none. We're putting up various barriers for various groups of people, particularly the elderly, the students, low income, homeless, and now we have a new category, which is people whose homes have been foreclosed. And we're putting up different barriers to all these people that not only make it more difficult, but they're useless. They don't serve a purpose except to make voting less accessible.
Are there other thoughts from the panel or audience on, and Jeff, if I understand you correctly, you're talking about a government-issued identification that's done by digital equipment at the county boards, correct?
In lieu of a driver's license that 90% or more of the people have, let's face it, the people that don't have birth certificates today, and that's the thing of the past, that don't have them, and maybe back in 95 years ago they didn't issue them, I don't know. But I think the average citizen
Okay, I think there's two issues with that. If anybody wants to address the, you know, certainly philosophically on that, but also administering that type of card and having that available to voters. Whoever, audience, panel, whoever.
I just want to make two quick comments. I think that that's a really interesting question empirically, whether 90% of the people really do have this. And I think one of the biggest divides in our country has to do with, which might say rural versus urban. And rural, you know, everyone knows everyone kind of mentality, and urban, not so much. And I think one of the things that you'll discover if you start calling registered voters is that a huge fraction of them are not where they're supposed to be. They're constantly moving around. And it's just a fact of our civilization that a lot of people are much more marginal than our mental model might suggest. I don't mean in a negative way to them, but I'm just saying that our mental model may not be actually accurate. I mean, the people you know and the people I interact with may not be representative of what we're actually looking at. And so I think that is part of what's driving this disconnect on this particular issue.
I agree. I think our culture, our society is much more transient than it was some time ago. And I think in terms of the call for photo ID, one thing just to keep in mind, I'm not sure what the proposal is and whether the gentleman that proposed that is contemplating that be done at the polling place. If that's the case, then you need to keep in mind resources, the strain on polling place operations that might cause, excessive wait times, et cetera. And then I guess the question really to be posed is, if the goal is identity verification, is one form more certain than the other? Is a photo ID more capable of confirming identity than a signature, for example? So I throw that out as food for thought.
Other questions, comments? And if folks have a question or comment, go ahead and step up to the microphone.
Dorothy Stang from the Geauga County Board of Elections. I think the reason that we got away from signature verification is I'm quite sure that every board of election in here, either through a petition of some sort or an election day issue, has been challenged on the fact that we are not handwriting experts. And so consequently, we have shied away from being the, quote, handwriting expert in the office to verify signatures. That is nothing that we have done. It is something that has been put upon us through lawsuits. And so consequently, everybody shies away from verifying for sure that is that person's signature, either from the card to the petition, from the card to the signature at the polling location. So that is something that has evolved over the years, and people are shying away from it. I myself included. I used to verify signatures all the time on petitions. 20 years ago at the Board of Elections. I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole right now.
Thank you, Dorothy. And Karen, you might be able to answer this. I know you said there are some states, I think Tennessee is one, that has the cards with signature. How do they with litigation? And
I'm not aware of litigation in those jurisdictions where signature verification is the practice. I will, just to clarify my suggestion here, I'm not suggesting that poll workers or election officials be burdened with verifying signatures. What I am thinking, though, is that the technology exists for electronic signature verification much in the same way that signatures are verified in other contexts at banking institutions and elsewhere. But I do think officials and poll workers are burdened enough with what they already have to do, and I'm not advocating that they take on signature verification. Tennessee is one of those jurisdictions that verifies signature, as does Oregon, as I mentioned earlier, with their mail-in voting program. The voter signs the mail-in ballot and that envelope and then returns it to the precinct, and at that point the signature is verified, I believe, electronically.
Yes. Ruth Littleholt, Crawford County Board of Elections. When the voter ID requirement came out in 2006, I wasn't in favor of it because I do the poll worker training. But we've had it in place for 2 years, and I think the poll workers have embraced it very well in our county. Yes, it's a little complicated, but most of the people come into the polls with their driver's license. You know, they're in line and they're getting their driver's license out or their other form of ID, and they're there to present it. And the same thing in the office when they come in to vote absentee. You know, we aren't even required to see it, and they already have it out and want to show it to us. So I think, you know, it's going to be more confusing to go back just to signatures, and I think it's given the voters more confidence in our system. And also, we are a small county, but we did have some fraudulent voter registrations this fall, and if we hadn't caught them and we just had signature verification, they could have went in, you know, it would have agreed in the signature book, and they would have been allowed to vote and not have any address verification.
Thank you. And Ruth, a question to you on that. You mentioned that most people show ID there. For those that don't, are you doing anything additional on poll worker training with the poll workers, since they're not kind of bogged down with all of the different rules? Is there anything that you can suggest or anything you're doing that assists the poll workers in kind of all of the different requirements?
Well, one thing, we do train our poll workers every general and if we have a primary election. So we're going over it more than just once a year or every 3 years. And it's, you know, in our instructions, and then we had the flip chart from the Secretary of State this time. So, you know, I think they're learning it.
Thanks, Ruth. Marilyn?
Hi, thank you. Lorain County again. Hi, Brian.
Hey.
Just a couple of observations, and one is also in 2006, after the ID requirement came into being, going around doing demos and so forth with our local National Federation of the Blind, we were pleasantly surprised to find that the entire group was very positive about the new ID requirement. Presumably they don't have a driver's license, but they didn't see it as an issue. And they said it's an idea whose time has come, that we did need it, and they felt better about the election process in that all voters, including them, would have to have an ID. We also then went to the local group of deaf who experienced the same thing, or it conveyed to us the same thing. So I don't know that there's this universal thing that people can't get a driver's license and that they oppose the ID. We're finding actually exactly the opposite. In this past November election, we had quite a few busloads of people who were homeless who were brought in to register. They didn't have a problem with ID. So I think that we're finding that people are certainly complying and in many cases are welcoming. When I first, or at the beginning of our session here, we were talking about the driver's license. I do think if there's a change in that, and maybe someone did mention it and I didn't catch the first few minutes of this session, we have two numbers, and clearly we need to do something in the design of that driver's license to get rid of the one that doesn't have the RH or whatever in the beginning of it, and I think that would eliminate most of the problems that poll workers or voters have knowing which number to use. Thank you.
I think that's an excellent point. I know in some of our publications and voter education materials, we've specified it's this number, not that number, because voters do get confused on that. Joanne?
I'm Joanne Karasek, and I want to discuss something that Brian said. You said that because Indiana's law was ruled constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court, that means our law is constitutional, but there's a variation in our law because there's a difference in what it takes to get an absentee ballot as to what it takes to get a walk-in ballot. And since the absentee ballot is so much easier, it takes a little more than a signature in the last four digits of your Social Security number. It also takes registration, and it also takes an address. But anyhow, when that is all that's required and we have to go through this hullabaloo to walk in and vote, I think that a court would hold that that's an unconstitutional denial of equal protection. Now, I saw that issue raised in one case, I think in the last year or two. Peg, you might know about it, but in the resolution of the case, I didn't see any ruling by the court on that issue. And it seems to me it's really unfair to require all this stuff if you go walk in, and all you have to do is those four things for an absentee.
Well, like I said yesterday, I'm no constitutional scholar by any stretch, but one of the law professors pointed out that in one of the conversations that we were having, that because that option is available to anyone to vote by absentee ballot, with only providing the last four digits of their Social Security number, I don't think it's a due process violation. I don't think it's an equal protection violation. Is it problematic from a policy standpoint? Why should there be a lesser ID requirement for absentee voting than there is for in-person voting? I don't know. That's a policy call. I think that if last four digits SOC is appropriate for absentee and we're not seeing a huge amount of fraud with absentee voting, then why couldn't it also be the same for in-person voting? But again, that's a policy choice. That's not something that I'm weighing in on one way or the other.
Well, I don't think that they're equal situations. I will never, ever vote absentee unless I'm forced to, like I'm in a hospital.
That's a personal choice.
Yeah, but I have a legal reason to make that choice. I happen to know that absentee votes are the most insecure voting system you can have. And I want my vote as secure as it can be. So, and I think that's a reasonable reason, and it's not equal. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think you've raised a really interesting question, though, that's occurred to me, too, that when you show up in person and you personally have to face an election official, you have to provide identification. But when you mail it in and nobody ever sees who's mailing this, you don't have to provide all that good identification. Frankly, I think it's just bizarre.
Right, you do have to apply for the absentee ballot, right?
Yeah.
Have a signature match.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
and then have the absentee ballot. So this is just mail-in absentee ballot. That's
yeah.
So there are all these parameters.
There's a lot
but,
of hoops.
But it's all done yeah. on faith.
But
yes. And I agree with Dora that there are a lot of hoops.
Right.
Absentee voting, I think, is more secure because first of all, that application has to meet everything on file with the Board of Elections before the board will ever issue an absentee ballot.
Right.
Then it goes back. Then it comes back in. And again, the law is very strict. It has to absolutely match everything on file with the Board of Elections. My only point was that if the last four digits is good enough for absentee voting, and even for provisional voting, some people don't realize, and I don't want to get in that hornet's nest about provisional voting, but if you don't have ID on election day and you vote a provisional ballot, you're in the poll book, but you don't have ID. You vote a provisional ballot, you provide the last four digits of your Social Security number. You do not have to come back to the Board of Elections and provide any additional ID, and assuming that you are registered, your vote will be counted. So again, that's the second example of where last four digits of your SOC is good enough.
I have a question about hold on, Dora, 1 second. We have a lady that's been waiting at the mic.
Okay, I'm Pat Armstrong from the Crawford County Board of Elections. My real job, full-time job, is at the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, so I'm going to give you just a little information. Number one, we're about 6 to 9 months too late in changing the driver's license because about 2 months ago they changed the design of the driver's license.
Hmm.
And there's still the driver's license number is permanent now. Your RH, whatever, is permanent for the lifetime you have a driver's license, and I don't think you're ever going to get that changed. The number on top of your head is still there. They start now with the agency that you get your driver's license and a two-letter and like nine-digit
mm-hmm.
number that is actually your application number of what you applied for your driver's license that day you received it.
Plus, it's right across where it says driver's license, right? So it looks like
right, exactly. But it just changed a couple months ago. And just on another note, we require people to have an ID to vote. I'm telling you, people are not having a problem coming up with a birth certificate and a Social Security card to cash their federal income tax check, because we've been very busy for the last 6 weeks. They all have the documents and they all have the money because they have to cash their check.
Thank you, Pat. Thanks, Pat.
So I'm having trouble understanding how provisional ballots are ever rejected on the basis of no ID, because if a poll worker is correctly trained to put in the last four digits as a fail-safe of the Social Security number, or alternatively, if people don't have a Social Security number, then they can fill out a 10-T form?
Right.
So those are the two fail-safes, and a 10-T form will allow a person's ballot to be counted if they have no Social Security number. Is this a poll worker training issue? Are we not getting those last four digits?
I think I'm going to say two things, and then I'm going to defer to my mentor, who I never get to publicly acknowledge this, but everything I know, Pat Wolf taught me, so, and I thank her for that.
But, hey, Brian, for a clarification, I probably everything we all know, Pat Wolf taught us.
Yeah. But Dora, you're right. I think that it's two issues. I think a small percentage of them are the people who are required, because there's four circumstances, and again, I'm not trying to get into the labyrinth of provisional balloting. That was for a separate session. Thankfully, I wasn't there, because I heard it was a pretty raucous session. But there are four categories of people who must go to the Board of Elections after Election Day to provide follow-up information within that 10-day period. I would imagine that the bulk of people who are rejected for no ID are the ones who never bothered to follow up. On the other hand, I think there are, and we saw that in the Franklin County litigation, these laws are so arcane, it's so complicated. The only thing that my understanding, and Pat can correct me if I'm wrong, that the poll worker is absolutely required to write in is the person's name. If they refuse to do so, there's no requirement that the poll worker write in anything else on the ballot. But it is complicated, it is difficult, and of course we have 88 different boards of elections trying to interpret these complicated laws, and even though we could put a lot of effort in the directives, they're still complicated too, so I think some of it is variation from board to board, and I think some of it is just the people who either refuse to provide any form of ID or fail to follow through like they're supposed to.
Brian pretty well covered, because a lot of the issues with the provisionals is the lack of the follow-up by the person if they didn't have ID with them, do possess it but didn't bring it in, the fact they don't do that piece, or they absolutely refuse to provide any ID. I mean, they just literally do not want to provide it. Even though they have it, they refuse to provide it. So as far as stats, I don't have anything on those as to go down to that detail for those type of reasons, but that's the main things that we've been seeing, and from the boards when we're talking with them, it's probably the primary reasons that you see on the ID piece of it.
We have about 15 minutes left, so keep the questions, comments coming. I'll cut you off at about 2 minutes, just as a heads up.
15 minutes. I'm Tom from Huron County. A couple things I noted here. We have a lot of registrations when we check the signature, whether it be on petitions or on the poll book. Signatures from 1969, when these people first registered, we have a lot of people from 1969. Let's see, that's a long time ago. Their signature changes. We have people that change, life things happen, and people can't write with their right hand anymore, they have to write with their left hand. So signatures do change. As far as voter IDs, as a deputy director, I get a chance to talk to a lot of voters. Voters like the ID. They feel that it gives some validity to the assurance that this person is not registered. She's not going to be able to vote, but he is. That they feel, a lot of voters feel that there's confidence if people provide ID that it really is that person. A last one. There was a comment earlier about not trusting voter ID, or I'm sorry, absentee voting. I'm a I'm a registered voter, and I vote a lot. And I like going to the polls, but I can't go to the polls anymore because I have to stay in the office. So I vote absentee. I think if we look around at some of our colleagues here that actually work in the Board of Elections, most of them vote absentee, and probably a lot of people at the Secretary of State's office. So I think the people who count the votes, who want to make sure that my vote counts, I want to make sure my vote counts. I have the immense faith, I have so much faith that my vote counts as an absentee because I make sure it does, just like we make sure every vote counts as that's supposed to. Before we shut, as Board of Elections staff, before we print out the last report and give it to the board, is there anything else that we need to do? So we go through and we make sure that everything's been open, everything's been counted, and yes, we do take our job serious and we trust the system that we have.
Thank you. Other? Sure, yeah. Did you wanna?
Just a quick comment. I got the impression now that actually you are signature experts right about now, because I know that at Franklin they did this huge verification on these initiatives, and they processed thousands of signatures. And you know, I'm not an expert on the results of that study, and I the numbers I heard that they were rejecting, I kind of didn't believe that they could reject so many, to be honest. But I'm getting the impression that at least some of your community is much more of an expert than me, for example, on the signature question. And again, I'm not an advocate for going back to signature or against it or positive, but I just wanted to point that out.
Thanks, Dr. Allen. Robin?
I just wanted to bring up one thing. I know when we had in-person voting in Montgomery County, even though it was considered absentee balloting, people would come in and present their ID. And when you told them that it wasn't necessary because they were voting absentee, they were upset. How dare you not look at my ID or consider that as part of my voting? So I think people are getting used to it and they sort of expect it.
Thank you. Joanne?
I want to explain this issue of absentee balloting and why it's considered the least secure voting system. When an absentee ballot is sent out, it may be sent out too late for the person to possibly vote it by mail. Then also, it may actually never get sent out, as has happened in Florida. And then it goes through the post office, and they have found irresponsible postmen that apparently don't like the load of their job, and they throw the stuff in the waste can or whatever, and so it doesn't get to the person. Once it gets to the home, anybody in the house has as much access to that absentee ballot as the voter themselves, and if an overbearing husband chooses to vote his wife's ballot, that might be a problem, or vice versa. And then it goes back to the Board of Elections by mail again, and those risks. And once it gets to the Board of Elections, and some Board of Elections, for instance, in Washington State, they were known not to be recording what ballots came in, and so they were no longer of record as having come in. And then it sits around in the Board of Elections, and we keep on hearing incidents that after the election is over and the votes are counted, that a bag of absentee or three or whatever shows up and was never counted. So those are the holes, and many holes, in absentee ballots.
Kyle?
Hi, Kyle again. I'd like to ask two follow-up questions of some of the stuff that's been brought up. First, if some elections administrators in the audience could address Dr. Allen's question of when there are petitions, I think there's three things. You the name printed, signature, and then Social Security ID number, whatever, address, thank you. So why can't people just go around and kind of do that themselves? Who verifies that? How is that verification process worked through so there's no fraud? And then the second question is, I kind of like toying around with the idea of boards of elections and providing ID to those who don't. what if they can't provide ID in the beginning at the polling place, what are they going to provide to get that ID at the Board of Elections themselves? I mean, they're going to Social Security card, birth certificate. They don't have the other things. So I just had those two additional questions.
I just want to quickly just take the one off the table. I think what Professor Allen was talking about was statewide issue petitions. The biggest reason that those signatures were rejected was because those people were not registered to vote. And that we universally see that in the Secretary of State's office. These statewide petitions, like the stripper thing in 2007, the casino thing in 2008, they're notoriously unreliable. They pay people to sign those. Half the time, they're not registered to vote. That's the biggest reason those are rejected. It has nothing to do with elections officials nitpicking signatures on petitions. The people just flat out aren't registered.
Well, and Brian or Pat or any of the panelists maybe quickly address. I think you're asking about what is the verification process on the petitions?
Very briefly, I'll just take that too. We get the, if it's a statewide petition, it's filed with our office. We scan them all so that we have a copy. We're required to send it to the Board of Elections to check the signature. There's various voter registration systems in the counties in Ohio. I think there's like 6 or 8 different ones, Pat. They have a module in their voter registration system that pulls up an electronic version of the signature. They visually check that against the signature that's on the petition. They make a notation to make sure that the person hasn't signed twice in that module. And if any of you, you're shaking your heads, it sounds like I'm saying it right. And then they actually tally up on each part petition how many valid signatures, how many invalid signatures. They check the circulator statements, and then they make a report back to the Secretary of State's office.
Thanks, Brian. Anyone else on the panel?
If you've ever looked at petitions, which I used to years ago, it's not hard, really. If you have doubts, you question it. But they really are, people who circulate petitions, a lot of them are insulting. They must think election officials are idiots. If you get a bunch in the same handwriting, you aren't going to notice. Are they in alphabetical order? I mean, come on. And once you know that one person has circulated petition with that kind of nonsense on it, then you look at every petition that that person circulated, and you can guarantee they've screwed up on all of them. And if I can address quickly, somebody is concerned that we have all this ID so that people don't vote multiple times. If you really want to worry about people voting multiple times, may I suggest there is a simple solution that they use in all sorts of countries where people can't read and write. It's called the inky pinky. And when you vote, you get an inky pinky, and then you can't vote again that day. It's pretty simple. If that really is your concern, that's the way to deal with it.
Yes, sir.
Dale Fellows, Lake County, except for the fact that this ink doesn't last for 35 days.
Ah.
Okay.
That's a whole different question.
And to reinforce what you said, Peg, too, was about the signature, the petitions, all the other ones is where you think they make us look think we're stupid, is when they have the same circulator is in multiple counties all at the same time.
The same
That's
day,
always
yeah.
interesting. Signature changes. I agree about the signature changes. You can see I had a little surgery. I couldn't even imagine what my signature would look like now if election day were now. IDs, there's a whole lot of IDs and options, and I think someone else said it best is, you know, folks, when it comes to certain things, they can make darn sure that they find IDs and find certain IDs. And the overwhelming thing that since that ID requirement has come in is that I've heard from voters throughout the state and in my area is it's about time. And I mean, overwhelmingly, folks want like that and like the fact that they need to show ID and that they that brings way more confidence into it. And I was interested when I went to, in this Peg might you'd be interested in, I went to the Secretary of State's opening of her new office in Cleveland, and you couldn't get in the building unless you had a state ID or a valid driver's license. Okay? So the folks that you mentioned, Peg, that you're concerned about, couldn't even go to the Secretary of State's office.
You want me to defend paranoia?
Just overwhelmingly, that's what. But here's a suggestion. How about a voter IDs like what they do in Florida? When you register to vote, you get an ID, and you have to show that ID when you go to vote. It doesn't have to have a photo on it. It's got the address, though. And you get, I mean, when we sign up to be members of any organization or whatever, you get an ID card, and that gets you in, and that gets you voting. If you don't have that voter ID, you don't vote. You don't vote there. And then I heard a lot of folks talking about turnout. I think the turnout in Ohio's been pretty darn good when you look at the overall amount of eligible voters. But I always remember the great philosopher Yogi Berra, who said, you know, if people don't go to the ballpark, you aren't going to make them.
I want to follow up on Dale's point, and I think it Kyle's second question that I didn't address. I just didn't want to leave it unresolved. I agree with Dale that I think it would be a good idea for the boards of elections to be able to issue a voter ID. It certainly would satisfy the current requirements of Ohio law as an other government document. My only caveat would be I don't want to see it as another unfunded mandate on the boards of elections. I know for some counties it may not be an issue. I think for some of my smaller counties and even some of my medium-sized counties, it would be an expensive proposition. And again, I would support it as long as the money came to fund it.
We have time for one last question or comment or suggestion.
Probably a lot of you have looked at the CNN hotline from the last election. It's a really nice resource, and you can get it online, and they have the hot spots. And good news, Ohio is not as dark as a lot of the other states on their picture. Thank goodness. But the number one serious issue was I went to the polls and those jerks wouldn't let me vote. And I think the main issue has to do, my impression from reading the transcripts was I got my driver's license actually, but I moved. And so it's the transient nature of a lot of our citizens. And so I'm not sure that all, you know, then they could bring their, you know, they have many options, of course, but they're volunteers to be there in the first place. And they clearly were irritated, not necessarily at this state so much as other states. But I think one of the challenges that this community has to face is that challenge and how to make those people a little bit happier. It's just a thought.
For the Ohio Democratic Party, and 85% of the problems that we had were driver's licenses. Driver's licenses that had old addresses on them and our proper ID, and voters should have been getting regular ballots, and they weren't. They were being forced to vote provisionally. And it seems like a really simple fix. I'm not clear on why it's such a problem in terms of poll worker training, but it still is. So I would just say that I also would go back to a signature requirement if we could. I don't think we have the political will to do that. But given what we've got with voter ID, I would at least like to see more intensive poll worker training, maybe a flip chart devoted just to what IDs are okay to use. No, I know the flip chart. I love the flip chart. I've worked with it plenty. I mean, a little flip chart just with voter ID. What's a proper ID, because there are so many of them and it's so complicated.
Thanks, Dora. One final thing I want to say before I thank the panel that I think was really powerful, and probably 8 out of 10 of you that stood up today, and I've seen it in other panels. When you've spoken, you've talking about, you know, back in our county, the voters or the folks that I serve. And I think that's, as opposed to I think, that's one of the, I think, best things about this conference that I've gotten out of it, because you've actually taken voices from your counties that you serve or the constituents you do, and you've brought those up, and that is very telling because it's not just us in this room. So I want to thank everybody for doing that. I think that's really powerful. And I want to thank you all for coming to this session, and of course our panel, Pat, Brian, Peg, Karen, and Ted. Thank you very much.